This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Anne Enright read her story Solstice from the March 13, 2017 issue of the magazine. Enright has published 3 short story collections and 6 novels, including The Gathering, which won the Man Booker Prize in 2007, and The Green Road, which came out in 2015. That year, she was appointed Ireland's first fiction laureate. Now here's Anne Enright.
Solstice. It was the year's turning. These few hours like the blink of a great eye. Just enough light to check that the world is still there before shutting back down. Sometime in the mid-afternoon, he had an impulse to go home or go somewhere. And when he lifted his head, of course, it was dark outside. It just felt wrong. 2 hours later, he was in the multi-story looking for his car and he couldn't find the thing. It was like a lost dog. He clicked the key fob over and over, but there were no answering lights flashing orange on level 2 where he usually parked, or on level 3. He went up the little stairs to level 4, then along the tiny path on the side of the ramp to 4A, brushing against the live cars that were stuck on the slope, nose to tail. He glanced into the windows as he went past, and there was a gone look to the drivers' faces. They'd already left for home. Out there, it was Christmas. But he did not think it was Christmas inside the multi-story, the only place in Dublin that had no fairy lights. He walked the last ramp to level 5. Above him, the black concrete angles of the car park roof gave way to the night sky, and the car was right there, out in the weather. He took a moment to glance up and around him at the longest night of the year. It felt like the end of things. Made you want your religion back. He looked out over the landscape of West Dublin, the square industrial units set among dark young trees, and he entertained the possibility that it would not work this time. This time, the world would spin deeper into shadow. And because the exit ramps were still jammed, he stayed a minute to check the solstice on his phone. For some reason, it didn't always happen on the same day, but in 2016 it came just when he thought it should, on the 21st of December. Not at midnight, though. The event, as the website called it, would happen at 10:44 a.m. Irish time. Somewhere in that moment, whether he believed it or not, the sun would pause in the sky above him, or seem to pause. It would stop in its descent and start its slow journey back to summer and the middle of the sky. Or this year, he thought, it might not bother. The M50 was at a crawl and there was the usual nightmare getting off at the Tallaght exit. He could see the red tail lights running in a sequence towards him until he pushed his own brake pedal down. It would be stop-start all the way to Manor Kilbride. A full 40 minutes later, the dual carriageway turned into the old Blessington Road, and oncoming traffic shot by so close he flinched in the glare of the lights. This was the part of the journey that he loved best. The street lamps gave way to the idea of countryside, and there was a song on the radio as the road opened up ahead. The music made him feel like he could keep driving forever. It was a love song, or a sad song. It reminded him of a time in his life, some town he was in, he could not say where. The loss of that place made him unsure of this one, or indifferent, as though he could clip an oncoming car and it wouldn't matter. And he didn't know what he was thinking until a truck bellied past, sucking the air from the side of the car. It gave him a fright. He checked all the mirrors and shifted in his seat, set his hands more deliberately on the steering wheel. After the turn off, he followed his own headlights down a country lane, and when he got to the house, he sat in the parked car for quite a while. The night was very big out here. There were 3 texts on his phone, 10-15 minutes apart. When home? Will I put your name in the pot? Food anyway, 7:30. When he comes in the door, there's a smell of cooking, the sound of pans and of waters pouring into the sink. His daughter is failing to set the table and complaining about the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's like so unfair, she says, and her family neither agrees nor disagrees because that's just asking for it. Ruth is 15. She's arguing with her own shadow, her mother, her teachers, none of whom care about the Dakota Access Pipeline or not enough for her. We live in County Wicklow, her mother sometimes likes to remind her, but Ruth does not see what location has to do with anything. And he would admire this more, he might even take up the discussion, but she's back on her phone. He glances over her shoulder and for once she lets him see. What's that? Just, she says. A person called Chicken Penis has sent a funny picture to do with Kanye's breakdown, a video clip that jerks and repeats endlessly. It's hard to know what the joke is. And what kind of person spells penis right and chicken with two K's? Is that someone you know? Ruth just rolls her eyes, types with two thumbs, cracks up laughing, saying, oh my God, oh my God. He looks into the kitchen where his wife is trying to serve up stir fry out of a too heavy pan. She's in her track pants, upstairs all day at a guess, translating some car manual for solid German euros. Her hair's in a scrunchie, which does not suit her. He tries to remember the song he heard on the radio as he goes over to help, but go, go, out, she says. And it is gone. Halfway through dinner, he becomes aware that Ross, his son, is talking to him about something or someone called Stripey. His son says that Stripey knew about death because he always went to Tiger's grave. After a moment, he realises that Stripey is a cat, and so is Tiger, the ones at the childminders when Ross was little. Cats from many years ago. Animals believe in death, his son says. You think? This is a big statement for a 10-year-old. Maybe he was just waiting for the other cat to come back out of there. I mean, maybe he doesn't know what the ground is. Maybe he doesn't believe in the ground. The boy's face goes still and he looks at his plate. Ruth goes, does a carry hand out of the grave and there's an immediate fight, shouting, pushing. Hey, hey, that's enough, he says. When they are settled, his wife casts a baleful look at him and he shoots one back. What have I done now? I think the cat was sad, she says to Ross. I think Stripey missed Tiger, don't you? She's put her hand on the loose fist his own hand makes beside his plate. This is one of the things they fight about. Stop undermining your own son. Which irritates the hell out of him because the boy has to learn how to roll with the punches. Could have been hungry, he says. Yum, yum, dead cat. Ruth starts to laugh and Ross obliges him with a crooked smile. His wife pushes back from the table, starts collecting the plates, though they're only just finished. Sorry, that was so, she says. It was just a rustle up. Lovely, he says. Oh, great, he thinks. On the longest night, his wife with that look in her eye that says, Christmas is coming and it's all turning to shite. Correction. His wife with a look that says, Christmas is coming and it's all your fault. He pours a glass of wine and almost spills it on himself, falling asleep on the sofa after the news. He was dreaming about weather, or discussing the weather with his dreaming self. All autumn it had been so dry. High pressure, clear skies, the leaves drying to dust on the trees, falling like smoke they hung on so long. It occurs to him that Tiger was Stripey's mother, the cat's mother, no less. He says as much to his wife, who's sitting across the room. She looks at him. Yes, she says. And he suddenly remembers that his own mother is dead, a fact he manages to forget for days at a time. You'd think they'd make a better go at the names, he says. Later, he mutes the TV to check on a noise and hears his daughter singing upstairs. She has her headphones on, her voice half in her head, half in the room. Goddamn truck, he says. Nearly had the wing mirror, you know the bend. Be careful, his wife says. This time of year, they're all drinking. They're all wrecked, he says. I was half asleep myself. No, not asleep. She looks slightly shocked. Just a bit unmoored. That is the word he was looking for. Recently he feels he has felt unmoored. He used to have a place in his mind where he could go. Hard to say where it was, but his mother has been dead since April, so maybe this was the place she used to occupy. Because he can't go there anymore. It was the song reminded him. I was listening to the radio, he says. The radio. It wasn't like an inner monologue or anything. He did not sit around talking to his mother all day. It was more like a silence. He had lost a great and wonderful silence. The traffic came against him and he felt unprotected, bullied by the lights because he had no one on his side anymore, not even his wife. Yes, the radio in the car, you know. I wish for once you'd let me say something without repeating it back at me like some kind of gom. She lets this sink in for a moment and then gets up out of the big armchair and leaves the room. He can hear the sound of her starting to unload the dishwasher in the kitchen. And Mutual, he wants to shout after her. Fucking Mutual! He wants to tell her how he sat in the car outside his own house thinking, whatever happens when I walk in the door, that's the thing. When I walk in the door, I will find it. The answer or the question, one or the other, it will be there. And what did he find? These people. This. Even in her sleep, she is affronted, her body straight in the bed beside him, her head twisted to face the wall. The earth spins them toward morning, and he cannot close his eyes for the vertigo. He has to urge it on. He wakes without knowing he has slept, and the house is busy around him, the sound of the front door finally, and silence. It's after 9 o'clock, but when he comes into the kitchen, Ross is still at the table, stuck on his phone. It's the Christmas concert, his son says, as if that explains something. The office is closed, but he still has a mad number of payments to process before the end of the year, so he takes a coffee back to bed and opens his laptop there. He clicks on a spreadsheet, then he starts reading the news instead and wandering about online. Ross comes in to show him something. He climbs across the duvet, bringing the phone screen so close that his father has to push the thing a distance away. It's a video of two tigers play fighting in the Siberian snow. They are pretty impressive, the tigers. Fantastic, he says. And Ross is so pleased. His cheeks glow with it. It is 10:38 and outside the sun has not cleared the tops of the winter trees. Look up solstice, he says, spelling it out for him and then typing it on his own keyboard because he's running out of time now. He's 6 minutes to do this, to tell his child that the world will keep turning. No matter what happens, the sun will always rise in the morning. The planet's orbit will tilt them towards the light. He finds a video clip of a cartoon Earth circling a harmless small sun, but Ross says he already knows about the solstice. They covered it at school. It is 10:42. The boy is sitting cross-legged on the bed beside him. Ross shuts his eyes and shh, he says. Is it happening? In a minute. Is it now? The seconds pass. The boy squeezes his eyelids tighter. Now? Yes. Ross keeps his eyes shut for another moment, then punches the air. He turns to his dad and they look at each other full of mischief and amazement. Because it happened. Nothing happened, but they know it was there, the tiny stretch of daylight that will become summer. His wife is home. She's standing in the doorway watching them. They look up and smile at her. What? She says.
That was Anne Enright reading her story Solstice. This is her fifth story in The New Yorker. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Mary Gaitskill reads The 548 by John Cheever. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.